This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 20, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Washington considers three proposals to address global warming, not one of which meets the standards of the Kyoto Protocol. Community activists in the Los Angeles area organized to protect the rights of immigrant day laborers. And we'll take a look at the Roma refugee struggle to return to their lands in Kosovo. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell, and these are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Opposition leader and anti-Syrian Saad al-Hariri claimed victory Monday in Lebanon's elections, beating pro-Syrian Christian former minister Frangia. The anti-Syrian party also won parliament, which breaks Syria's hold over the country. The campaign of Hariri was built on the popular energy of the demonstrations that took place after his father's assassination. The people protested over Syrian troop presence and with hopes of changing Lebanon's political system. And in Iranian elections, a runoff will take place in the first democratic election in that country in 25 years. The runoff will take place between hardline conservative and former mayor of Tehran Ahmadinejad and reform candidate Rafsanjani. In a rare show of opposition in Iran, leftist candidate Karoubi, who came in third, spoke out saying that the Ahmadinejad's strong showing was the result of voter fraud. Two newspapers were closed on Monday for publishing their claims of vote rigging. Norman Solomon is the author of War Made Easy and was in Iran for the elections.
A lot of people I talked to just didn't want to vote in the first round because they thought that there were just too many reasons to be pessimistic. But my sense is that with such a stark choice in the runoff, a lot of the people who didn't vote the first time out because they're on the progressive end of the spectrum are so intent on stopping the extreme fundamentalist mayor of Tehran from winning the presidential election, I think people are going to go and vote.
The runoff election will take place this Friday. Violence erupts amidst a series of diplomatic meetings in Israel and the Palestinian territory. Tomorrow is a summit meeting between Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian President Mohammed Abbas. They are expected to speak about how to continue peace talks. Manar Jabrin reports.
After U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice visited the Palestinian Authority area and Israel to ease tensions, and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon agreed on demolishing vacated settlers' homes in the Gaza Strip after pullout, violence continued to escalate. In the morning, Israeli troops shot dead an unarmed 17-year-old Palestinian and wounded another while bird hunting in an area near the Israeli settlement of Netzarim in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, an Israeli settler was killed by Palestinian gunfire near the West Bank city of Tul Karem. The Islamic Jihad movement claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it came as a response to the ongoing Israeli attacks against Palestinian civilians. Even so, Islamic Jihad reaffirmed commitment to the calm period declared by all Palestinian factions earlier this year. For Free Speech Radio News from the International Middle East Media Center, IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
The Pentagon announced Halliburton has been awarded a $30 million subsidy to build a 220-bed prison for terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Grace Cho has the story.
The new prison building called Detention Camp 6 will replace some of the older facilities at the Navy base, which officials say are not adequate for holding prisoners for a long term. In the existing prison in Guantanamo, there are about 520 prisoners from the Bush administration's war on terrorism. Already $110 million has been spent on construction there, and the prison costs about $95 million a year to operate. However, unleashing waves of criticism and debate has been occurring since Congress approved the construction. Many civil rights groups are calling for Guantanamo to close since the prison became the symbol of abuse and represents the U.S. detention system. Furthermore, they are concerning that the decision will fuel international concern and undermine international standards. Kellogg Brown and Root Servicing Corporations is to complete the construction work by July 2006. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Grace Cho.
Halliburton is also the subject of a subpoena. Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat from California, asked to subpoena documents that would expose why U.S. officials withheld information from international auditors about $177 million in Halliburton overcharges that were billed to the Development Fund for Iraq. And the House of Representatives is expected to vote and pass today $45 billion for Iraq. That is in addition to the $350 billion Congress has already allocated to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And at a South American leaders' summit, Venezuela proposes the creation of a South American energy ring. Greg Wilpert reports from Caracas.
Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez arrived in Asunción, Paraguay yesterday. He proposed the creation of an energy ring that would link Venezuela, Peru, Bolivia, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil via a natural gas pipeline. Chavez made the proposal at the 28th summit of countries belonging to the Common Market of the South, or Mercosur. Venezuela, which has the largest natural gas reserves in the Western Hemisphere, is very interested in being part of an energy ring project so as to advance Latin American integration and to promote the idea of creating a continent-wide energy company known as Petrosur. The energy ring proposal has attracted much interest because of the energy crisis existing in various parts of Latin America, such as in Argentina. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate is planning to consider three different proposals to address global warming this week as part of the energy bill. The proposals range from offering incentives to polluting companies to reduce the amount of dirty emissions to mandates that would require companies to reduce their emissions over the next 15 years. Nevertheless, none of the proposals meet the standards of the Kyoto Protocol. Mitch Jezerich reports from Capitol Hill.
As Japan, Russia, and the European Union begin implementing the Kyoto Protocols to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide emissions, the U.S. Senate is just now debating the issue of global warming.
The window of opportunity for preventing dangerous global warming is closing very rapidly.
Daniel Alshoff, the science director of the Natural Resources Defense Council Climate Center, says the U.S., who emits about one-fourth of the world's greenhouse gases, must act soon to curb the negative effects of global warming.
We've had historic droughts in the Southwest. We're seeing ecosystems already beginning to change as a result of the changes in climate that are ongoing. So, and this is just the beginning. So this is a problem that you can't solve overnight once you've seen all of the damage. You've got to take action well in advance in order to slow it down.
The Senate this week plans to vote on three different amendments to the energy bill aimed at slowing down the number of carbon dioxide emissions released within the United States. The most dramatic proposal by Senators John McCain and Joe Lieberman would require a reduction in emissions by 2010 and to be no higher than the number emitted during year 2000.
I'm sorry this is happening. I'd like to see the administration far more involved in this issue. There's a requirement, for example, of reports on greenhouse gas emissions that are being ignored by the administration.
Senator McCain appeared on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, where he had tough words on how the Bush administration has handled the issue.
The terrible thing about climate change is that we're not going to see the effects of this for some years ahead of us, although we're seeing some now in the Arctic and the Antarctic and other manifestations of it. But the worst effects of it are down the road. And if we wait until those effects have taken place, then it's going to have serious consequences.
The McCain-Lieberman proposal goes the farthest of the three amendments being proposed, but not all environmentalists are supporting it as of now.
Joe and I added a nuclear component to it, which has upset some of the environmental groups. We did that because we believe that with 20% of America's energy supply today being supplied by nuclear and that being reduced, that in the state of technology, we need to add that as a component.
We don't support the bill as it is, and we're really focused on trying to get the subsidies for nuclear power out.
Again, Daniel Alshoff with the NRDC.
Because we think they're a dangerous diversion from the technologies that are most cost-effective in reducing global warming pollution.
Another greenhouse gas proposal by Democratic Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico got a boost as a Republican sponsor of the energy bill, Senator Pete Domenici, indicated that he may support it. Bingaman's amendment would begin reducing the growth of carbon dioxide emissions by placing mandatory caps. The plan purportedly would stop the increase of emissions by year 2020, but it would not reduce the amount to previous levels, as with the McCain-Lieberman proposal. The president of the environmental group Clean Air Watch, Frank O'Donnell, says it would be a historic moment if the Senate voted for either of the proposals, marking the first time Congress voted to cap carbon dioxide emissions. But O'Donnell says that neither proposal goes far enough in addressing the problem.
We are on course to have a warmer climate over the next 100 years, potentially significantly warmer, with repercussions that range from rising sea levels to stronger hurricanes to potentially other things as well. And that in order to really restrain that, we may have to make reductions on the order of 60% or more of emissions from today's level.
The third proposal, being brought by Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, would attempt to encourage companies to voluntarily reduce emissions with tax breaks and loans. Hagel's proposal is similar to what the White House wants to do. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The best-selling and most widely distributed newspaper in the Mexican state of Oaxaca has been under siege since Friday when the newspaper's offices in Oaxaca City were surrounded by hundreds of people, including children and seniors, who claim to be employees on strike. The staff and editors of the paper say the crowd has nothing to do with the media outlet and that the people were bussed in from a nearby town taking direction from a local politician. Vladimir Flores and Shannon Young file this report from Oaxaca City.
The newspaper's owner says the state government's antagonism towards Noticias began 4 years ago when then-Governor José Murat unsuccessfully attempted to acquire 50% of the newspaper's shares. During the final days of Murat's administration in November 2004, a tract of land, including a warehouse containing the paper's printing supplies, was seized by gunmen and later occupied by squatters. Although Noticias filed a formal complaint, state authorities did nothing to recuperate the terrain, prosecute those involved in the seizure, nor to investigate the identity of a cadaver left behind by the gunmen. On June 12th, the National Human Rights Commission published a statement condemning the inaction of the Oaxacan authorities in the matter. After midnight on Friday morning, a large group of people blocked the entrances of the newspaper's offices in Oaxaca City. The Noticias staff was inside preparing that day's edition for its print run. At shift change, the newspaper's employees realized that the crowd was aggressively preventing people from entering or exiting the building. Noticias owner Ericel Gomez Nucamendi says that 31 people have been trapped inside of the building since Friday.
They're from different areas. The newspaper's director and assistant director, as well as colleagues from other departments, are there. Today, they find themselves in conditions of insecurity because there's always the fear of reprisals from these invaders.
State authorities are refusing to act on the matter, saying that the situation is the result of a labor dispute and that the people outside of the newspaper's offices are workers exercising their legal right to strike. However, Noticias employees say that this is not the case. Noticias is reporting that the crowd was organized by union boss David Aguilar Robles, who is also a representative in the state legislature with the PRI, a party that has continued to dominate the political scene in Oaxaca despite losses at the federal level. Jaime Medina has worked at Noticias for 22 years and represents the employees' collective bargaining organization. While workers at the paper have been asking for a raise, Medina denies that the people blockading the offices work at the paper.
They brought in people that have absolutely nothing to do with our paper because the workers aren't in favor of starting a strike, because many of us directly depend on our source of work. What was in our best interest was to negotiate the collective work contract.
Faced with government inaction at the state level, Medina thinks the federal authorities should step in. Although the circumstances surrounding the case of Noticias are unusual, Noticias crime reporter Tomas Martinez Juarez views the events in the context of an intensifying climate of insecurity for press freedoms in Mexico.
What's happening is that in Mexico, in recent years, it's become dangerous to tell it like it is. Now the Noticias newspaper is experiencing governmental repression, but also in other states, especially with organized crime. The newspaper director in Veracruz, the radio reporter in Nuevo Laredo, who was also assassinated, these murder cases were tied to drug traffickers. While here in Oaxaca, what's happening with the Noticias newspaper is repression from the government for being independent, for telling it like it is.
Despite the physical blockade at its offices, the Noticias staff has been able to continue publishing the daily newspaper, printing in another city and distributing copies with unmarked trucks. However, it is unclear how long they can continue to work under the present conditions. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca.
It's been 6 years since the end of the U.S.-led NATO bombing campaign in Kosovo halted the Serbian crackdown on Kosovo's independence-minded Albanian majority. Among the key priorities of the United Nations administration is the return of Kosovo's refugee minority community, displaced after reprisal attacks by ethnic Albanians in 1999 and again in ethnic rioting in 2004. Now, the international community and the Bush administration are pressing for a swift return of Kosovo's status, but not at the expense of the embattled minority communities, normally referring to the approximately 100,000 Kosovo Serbs who remain in the province. Meanwhile, Kosovo's Roma, or Gypsy minority, have been lost in this political fallout, and, as Jackson Ehlers reports, over 8,000 members of one of the oldest settled-out Roma communities in Eastern Europe is still fighting to return to their former homes.
Driving with a UN official to one Roma camp in northern Kosovo called Žitkovac, remnants of a former Yugoslav mining complex go on for miles, the many slag heaps indications of a former heavy lead smelting past. Ethnic Albanians burned out the 8,000 Roma inhabitants living in an area known simply as the Mahalla, or community, in the nearby city of Mitrovica, the result of reprisal attacks in 1999. Now, 6 years on, UN officials are reeling from a series of scathing reports that accuse the international administration of knowingly setting up three makeshift Roma refugee camps on the former mine site, a place the World Health Organization calls an environmental disaster for the children living there. FSRN asked United Nations spokesperson Neeraj Singh what to make of the allegations that the UN was aware of the health problems since 2000, but failed to act to relocate the approximately 600 residents living near the mines.
We have been aware of these very serious health dangers that exist there. Despite all our appeals to the Romas to actually move out from there, they have been very unequivocally stating that they would only return to the Roma Mahalla.
Recently, or that's been their position the entire time?
Has been their position all the time.
Kosovo's top governor, UN mission head Soren Jessen-Pedersen, spoke about the situation during a visit to northern Kosovo.
Well, I think we all have a share of the responsibility.
Local and international authorities shared the blame, Jessen-Pedersen said, but he also blamed the Roma for being a, quote, particularly difficult group in negotiating their extraction from the contaminated site. As this reporter walked through the camp, humanitarian containers that were supposed to serve as temporary shelters have melded into a shanty town, taking on a feeling of permanence even though the camp was meant to exist for no more than a month. International attention has forced the United Nations and the Albanian-led government to deal with the Roma in Žitkovac after 6 years of neglect, but the camp leader, Habibi Hanini, and other non-governmental organizations working with the Roma contend that they have been cut out of the decision-making process that directly affects them. This includes an agreement to move the camp to apartment complexes that have not yet been built.
We heard that there was an agreement between the municipal president of Mitrovica, Faruk Spahija, and the international community regarding a plan for the Roma Mahalla. We were not present when they signed this agreement, and we actually didn't know about it until afterwards, and we still don't know what this plan is all about.
Kosovo's top legal watchdog in the province, the Polish human rights attorney and Kosovo ombudsperson, Marek Antoni Nowicki, admitted that the Roma were patently aware of the health risks to their families. When asked how the Roma justified endangering their children rather than simply moving to a safer location, Nowicki said it was a matter of being allowed to return to their original homes.
They understand that in order to have a chance and to keep a chance to go back to the Mahalla and to keep this Mahalla question on the proper level politically, the only way was to stay in these places and to stress that the only alternative is this Mahalla.
A donor conference to raise money to rebuild the Mahalla was organized for the first time in April. Again, representatives of the Mahalla were not in attendance. Making matters worse, the German government has made arrangements with the UN administration and local Kosovo authorities to forcibly return over 10,000 of the Roma community who sought asylum there after the Kosovo War in 1999. The only problem, according to UN sources, is that there are a few municipalities who are willing to accept the Roma population. Meanwhile, children in the Mahalla continue to get sick, and as one UN official said on the condition of anonymity, she fears the best thing for the 150-year-old Gypsy community is to leave Kosovo altogether. Reporting from the northern part of Kosovo, I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Immigrant day laborers in and around the Los Angeles area face tough working conditions. They gather near home improvement stores at dawn, waiting for hours to be picked up for temporary, often hazardous, and underpaid labor. This weekend, they found the support of local residents as community activists organized a counter-demonstration against the anti-immigrant Save Our State group rally. From the People Without Borders Collective at KPFK, Kelly Barnes has more.
Get out of us,
Immigrant day laborers and about 300 of their supporters showed up at a weekend rally intended to intimidate the workers. The anti-immigrant group Save Our State turned out 20 to 30 protesters in an attempt to shame home improvement store Home Depot for its perceived support of those who gather on the sidewalks to get work for the day. Lupe Moreno came to the rally with her two grandchildren, and she tells us why.
To protest Home Depot giving aid and comfort to illegal aliens that are trying to get jobs in front of their store. I like that they're here because if it comes on TV, the rest of the nation could see what their cities could become if we don't control the illegal alien.
In a company statement, Home Depot says the assembly of day laborers can pose a public safety concern for customers, employees, and the day laborers. The company says it is committed to pursuing safe solutions with input from all stakeholders. Day laborer Juan Perez is from Guatemala. He describes the day-to-day conditions he and other workers experience under unenforceable verbal contracts made with the people who hire him.
These racist groups that gather here at Home Depot claim the day laborers are terrorist groups, but we only come to this country to work. We are not here to cause damage or harm to anyone. We workers come here to make a little money, and that is barely enough to survive. Oftentimes, what happens is that a contractor will offer to pay $70 a day, and after the work is done, we only receive $50. If a worker questions this, he is told that he's illegal, and only then does the contractor ask to see documentation. There are six of us in my family in Guatemala. They depend on me, what I earn here and the money I send back there every month.
Save Our State founder Joe Turner says the circumstances that incited their members to protest against Home Depot run deeper than day laborer practices.
They fund day labor centers with local municipalities, and by funding day labor centers, they're helping illegal aliens get work and do other such things like, you know, learning English at these centers and things like that. That's aiding and abetting illegal aliens. That's something that should not be tolerated in our society. If illegal aliens were poor and ignorant and disease-ridden, if they're beneficial to our society, who exactly is not beneficial? Those of us with a four-year degree? Who's not benefiting society?
What diseases are you speaking about?
Tuberculosis, leprosy, goes on and on.
Counter-protester Susan Andres offers a different analysis and explains the sign she's carrying.
Capital travels freely, why not people? What the sign means is that the money, the wealth of the world can move around without any kind of obstacles. The people that have the wealth can move the wealth from country to country like they did just before the fall of Argentina when they sucked all the money out of Argentina and left the people, they couldn't even access their bank accounts. So the money can move around, but then the borders prevent people from following the money or from reclaiming the resources that have been stolen from their country. That's what the borders do. The borders keep us divided, a hierarchy of wages.
National Lawyers Guild members took up a collection from the counter-protesters to compensate the day laborers whose employers were likely scared away by the protest action. A bill, the first of its kind anywhere in the country, was introduced a few weeks ago by Councilmember Ed Reyes in the LA City Council. If passed, the ordinance would require every home improvement store in the city of LA to build a day labor facility with a bathroom and shade. From the People Without Borders Collective in Los Angeles, I'm Kelly Barnes for FSRN.
U.S. coal company executives attended the National Coal Show recently in the city they call the center of the coal industry, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But while the industry is predicting a bright future for the coal market, not everyone is happy about the new growth and techniques of coal mining. A coalition of groups from urban and rural western Pennsylvania and West Virginia held a protest march outside the coal industry trade show, while clean energy activists hosted a conference on the costs of coal power and argued for cleaner, renewable alternatives. Matt Topes has more.
Coal-fired power plants produce more than half of the electricity used in the U.S. today.
Pennsylvania and West Virginia are two of the top four coal-producing states in the nation. Residents from both states came together to denounce two different types of coal mining that they say are harming the region.
With underground mining, for example, the most prevalent practice in southwest Pennsylvania now is what's called longwall mining, where basically a giant machine that can be, you know, over a mile wide just cuts a swath along the coal seam and doesn't leave any support behind.
Jeff Frost, protest organizer from the group Canaries in the Coalfields.
The two biggest longwall mines in the country are both in Pennsylvania, Bailey and Enlow Fork, but they're both owned by Consol Energy Company.
Critics of longwall mining have called it a planned earthquake that destroys farmland and water sources on the surface. And in the neighboring state of West Virginia, a new coal mining practice called mountaintop removal has residents angry.
Where 3 million pounds of explosives are used each day in order to blow the tops of our mountains off, get down to thin seams of coal. This operation, mountaintop removal, destroys our water, destroys our air, destroys our communities. It has ill health effects on our citizens and our children.
Jessica McPherson, a Pittsburgh activist, says the impact of coal power on air quality is also a major environmental and public health concern.
In western Pennsylvania, we're at ground zero for the impacts of the production of coal. Our communities and our land are being degraded by mining, whereas the people in the cities are affected by the air quality degradation, which is a really serious health issue.
Bill Price is a resident of southern West Virginia and works with the Sierra Club's Environmental Justice Program.
And we're here to tell them that we are wanting and demanding a national energy policy in this country that works for the people and not the industry.
Tom Hoffman, vice president of Consol Energy, a Pittsburgh-based coal mining company, stood outside the National Coal Show and watched as the protesters rallied nearby.
They probably haven't asked, though, what would we do without coal? And somebody who advocates eliminating the use of coal needs to then propose the solution to what replacement will they have for coal. It won't be wind and solar. And to just say, well, we want to outlaw these practices without saying what you'll do to replace the product, I think is a bit irresponsible.
Hoffman, a company spokesperson, also referred to coal's future as very bright and stated that no other source compares to coal energy in terms of quantity. But 2 days prior to the rally, Mike Ewall had another view of renewable energy sources at the True Cost of Coal conference also held in Pittsburgh. Ewall is a clean energy activist from Philadelphia, and he presented examples of cleaner energy sources in use today, such as wind and solar power. Ewall criticizes the statements of industry spokespeople like Hoffman, who say that coal should continue to be the primary source of energy for the U.S.
The idea that we are going to need to use coal longer, so we should invest in more, that is ridiculous. Anyone that tells you there's a transition fuel argument in this, at least for electricity, tell them, no, you're wrong. Wind already exists, solar exists, and if you invest more in it, it'll become cheaper and more of it can exist.
This year, a call to action is uniting communities in Appalachia with activists from around the U.S. Mountain Justice Summer is made up of volunteers practicing nonviolent resistance against mountain range removal. For Free Speech Radio News, with Carlin Christie, this is Matt Toops from WRCT Pittsburgh.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.